This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
When I had been asked what I would talk about, and I threw some examples out of medieval Christian worship or the Dominican tradition of liturgy, I assumed it would be either one. And I was surprised to discover that I'm supposed to talk on both. So my own work has been principally on the religious life of lay people, especially in the Italian cities. So what I'm going to do is first talk about the religious experience in the time of Dominic, Francis, Thomas Aquinas, principally for Italy, which is the area I know best, for the laity. Then I'll talk a little bit about the experience of worship for my own religious order, for the clergy. And then I'm going to end up with, so we have the laity, the clergy, and I end up with clergy and laity together. So I will eventually get around to the Dominican rite and to our form of worship. One of the problems is if you read histories of Christian worship written by liturgists, they know virtually nothing about the Middle Ages. Their image of the Middle Ages was informed by the pre-Vatican II Catholic liturgy, and as a result, they read many things back into the Middle Ages that are simply not true. I don't know how good they are for antiquity, but this is a problem. The second problem is gross generalizations. So you will have an assumption that the way people went to Mass and what happened was the same in England, Germany, France, Italy, you name it. One of the things that my own work has shown me is that every place has its own religious culture. To paraphrase a former Speaker of the House of Representatives, all religion is local. There are two books that have played some role in calling this to people's attention, that if you're going to understand how people worshiped and what it meant to be a Christian, you have to ask where and when. You can't say that a 1,000-year period for all of Europe is the same experience. And even excellent historians of the liturgy like Jungmann make that mistake. The first is for the 1400s in England, there is a spectacular book, Eamon Duffy's Stripping of the Altars. And the second half of it, which is another, well, it's long, it's 600 and some odd pages. The second 300 pages is about the period of the Reformation, and that's nice. But the first half is the first time anyone has gone through the trouble to try and tell you what ordinary people experienced in their ordinary churches in England in that short period. It has not been done for any place else. Okay, in Gilbert, one of Gilbert and Sullivan's songs say, if you want in the world to succeed, how's this go? You must stir it and stump it and blow your own trumpet, or trust me, you'll never succeed. So I'm going to blow my own trumpet. The other one is my work on Italy in Cities of God, which is also a very long book, but you can pick any chapter and read it. And so I'm going to draw material from that as I talk tonight. The first thing I want to point out is that modern people have very little sense of place and very little sense of space. Space is something that's found up there, the moon and the stars, while for medieval people came from a place, and they lived in a place, and the spaces within the place mattered. For example, in northern Italy, documents that identify what towns belong to the city of Bologna and its outlying districts, and which are part of the city of Modena and its outlying districts. These are city-states. They said, the way you can tell is, if the parish church celebrates Bolognese saints, they're politically part of Bologna. If they celebrate saints from the cities around it, like Modena, Modenese saints, then they're Modenese. So the liturgy itself could tell you where the people were, even if no one could tell you where the boundary was politically. So you're part of a place. Also, what does it mean to be a member of a parish, to be a part of that place? It wasn't because you were on parish rolls. In the words of one of the statutes of the Archdiocese of Ravenna, people are members of the parish where, quote, they hear Mass and Vespers. Notice it's not just Mass, it's also Vespers. And I'm going to say more about the worship of the community that's more than simply Sunday Mass. Now, within the church, there are spaces. And those who come from the Eastern tradition know this because you have an iconostasis, which divides the sanctuary from the nave. Up until the Council of Trent, Western churches had the same kind of arrangement, the rood screen, and it existed from Scandinavia down to Sicily. It was everywhere. It was more open work than in the Eastern churches today. A good example, still intact, is in the Duomo in Venice, where you can come in and you see a series of columns that have an architrave across the top with candles on top of that. That would have been typical, and it would have been there in every parish. In the late Middle Ages, they begin to get filled up, but you have a demarcation between the nave and the choir, and the responsibility for the nave was the laity. The responsibility for the choir were the clergy. And what that meant was the decoration of the nave, what was there, was done by the laity. They're the ones who chose what the side altars were going to be. They're the ones who chose what kind of statues were going to be there. They're the ones who chose what was going to be painted on the wall. While it was the clergy on their side that were the ones who would decide what was going to be done in that area. There's an interesting story, 15th century, of a priest who had re-roofed a church, I think it is in Tuscany, and he put his family's coat of arms onto the ceiling in the nave. And when he was moved, somebody in the middle of the night came in with a stepladder and chiseled his coat of arms off the ceiling because that was the people's side, and he had claimed it as his own. Now, the screen is also, it's permeable. The Blessed Benvenuto Bojani, who's a Dominican penitent of the 13th century, was praying in the church in Florence, Santa Maria Novella, and she had a miraculous cure from the Blessed Virgin. And the first thing she did, and no one seemed to think this was strange, she came through the what would in the Eastern Church be the holy doors and went up to the side altar of the Blessed Virgin to light a candle and make thanksgiving. And she did this while the friars were singing matins. So there's a lot of mobility through the spaces. So it's sometimes the laity go to one side of the divider, for example, to receive the marriage blessing, while at the same time, sometimes the clergy come out, and I'll say more about that, and move around in the outside of the building. First, remember there are no pews. Pews were invented by the Protestants in the early 16th century so that people would have a place to sit to hear three-hour sermons. And they really confine you. They keep you stuck in a place. So when we're talking about places religiously, the places themselves, you're not assigned to them. Now, the one thing in the Middle Ages that you are sort of assigned to is, in Italy, and as far as I can tell elsewhere, men and women stood on the opposite sides of the church. One side for the men, one for the women being on the side of honor, the gospel side, and the men being on the epistle side, the southern side. They didn't sit, they stood. And to this day, there's an interesting phenomenon in conservative Anglican churches. Is anyone here, an Episcopalian, knows what withershins means? Well, one of the things about space is space here is connected with space in heaven. And one of the things you do is, when you're in a church, you should imitate the movements of the planets and stars in the sky. If you're in a ritual church, you probably have seen your priest incensing the altar, and he's going counterclockwise. The reason is the stars move that way, so he's imitating the heavens. Well, when you enter a church, you would enter, and you would always turn right. You'd never turn left, so that you would go around the church counterclockwise. So the women got to walk through the men's section. The men got dropped off, and the women then got to their own section. The men didn't go over there. So the spaces of the heavens, the spaces down here, they're all connected. What else do you find? And this is so true in Italy, less so in England, because the churches of Italy are city churches. The most important places in town are the places where the hometown boys and girls have made good. the local saints. Your church is on the city plan, so to speak, psychologically, if you're the one who has the saint's tomb that's the saint of your city. Over and the Italian cities in this period were producing more lay saints than will be produced until the pontificate of John Paul II. And many of them are tertiaries, third order members of the Dominican order too. I'll say a little bit more about them. Also, when you pray, you are not only move in sympathy with the heavens, you pray in sympathy with the heavens, which means that you pray facing east. And this phenomenon, old cathedrals and churches in Europe, the east, the altar will be in the east, people are looking east. But it was not only in the church building that the altar would be at the eastern end. Why? Because the Bible says that Christ will appear in the eastern sky. So when you're praying, you're waiting for him to appear. Not only that, when you prayed privately, you faced east. I have a wonderful story about this. A heretic from Cremona. This is in a register of Inquisitions of Heretics from 1299. His name was Armani Pungilupo. And there had been some suspicions because he had relatives who had been Cathars. Was he a Cathar? Well, he was a regular church attender. He regularly went to confession. He seemed quite normal, but you have over and over the comment being made by lay people, he doesn't face east when he's praying. And eventually it's found he's a secret Cathar. So the very act of not looking towards the east, not being in tune with the whole structure of the universe when you pray, that itself rings into question, is that person Orthodox? Now, in our churches, Dominican churches, which are monastic churches, the division was much stronger. What is called in Italy the Ponte, it's called in France the Jubbe, was a large structure that separated the people's part of the church from the friars' part. The one in Santa Maria Novella, destroyed after the Council of Trent, when they wanted visible ability for the lady to see the altar directly, not have it blocked, it was two stories high. It had six altars on the people's side in two ranks, up and down. It had an opening which had doors that opened and closed, but it really sealed off the monastic part of the building from the people's part. What's wonderful is that doesn't mean the people didn't have their own altar. If you go to Santa Maria Novella today, you will always come in through a door on the side, unless you're paying to see it as a monument. Then sometimes you go through the main door. That's where you pay. But if you're going in for services, you come in on the side into the people's vessel. And what do you see when you come in looking this way across the church? The altar is that way. You see Masaccio's famous crucifixion, considered basically one of the, if the first or if not the first, one of the first pieces of Renaissance art. That was painted above a now missing altar, which was the people's altar against the wall, where then if there was going to be a sermon, people could be around it and they could all hear. So the parish churches, much more permeable, the spaces, much more informal than the monastic churches. Now, I've said a little bit about the spaces and the places where people worship. Oh, before I finish that, moving around. When you're moving around in the church, it's like moving around through from city to city, because what you're doing is you are going from one sacred place to another for the purpose of worship, which means every movement within the church is like a little pilgrimage. So when the laity visit the different shrines in the church, even though it's all within the building, there's a sense that what you're doing on a small scale, microscopic scale, is what's done by those people who are going all the way to Jerusalem or Santiago. Okay, having said that, my one question that comes up, and I think the liturgical historians get this wrong, is the question of what people understood. The usual image is it's something like the pre-Vatican II church where the laity don't understand any Latin, and they're saying their Our Fathers or Hail Marys or reading prayer cards, and they can't even hear. Not the case, at least in Italy, where the place I know. Here's my favorite example. Some beggars had been arrested in Parma and were put into the city jail for begging. And they were all from Pisa. And of course, they knew who was the man to go to, the the local boy made good, sent Ranieri of Pisa, who was a founder of the hospital there. If you go to Pisa, his is the tomb that's in the south transept. It's gigantic. The north transept has the Blessed Virgin, and in some ways Ranieri has a bigger shrine because he's the hometown guy. So what do? The beggars, they pray. They pray to San Ranieri, help us get out of prison. And then what do? They sing in Latin Gregorian chant the Our Father three times. These are beggars. Well, our Lord and St. Ranieri heard them because Ranieri appears in a dream to all of them, tells them where there's a crowbar hidden behind a bench, and they pull the bars out of the window, and they escape and go back, and their votive offering with the story is to this day next to the shrine of San Ranieri in Pisa. Next, amount of comprehension. In the Middle Ages, unlike the modern period, it was expected that catechesis, learning to pray, involved learning to pray the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and the Apostles' Creed. And they were learned in Latin by everybody. This is from the north to the south. All other prayers were said in the vernacular, but the ones that come from a church council, the Creed, or from the Bible, the Hail Mary and the Our Father, those are in the sacred language. Now, you might wonder, did they really learn this? And here we have some scholarship. I don't know enough about, we don't have the evidence, but we do have enough in 16th century Spain. William Christian, who has written a wonderful book called Religion in 16th Century Spain, took advantage of Philip II. Remember the guy of the Armada? The one who was married to Mary Tudor? He loved to collect information. He never did much with it. And every 5 years throughout his entire reign, he would have commissioners visiting every parish in Spain. And what did they ask? Who were the local saints whose relics were there? What were the local ceremonies and things, the processions? When did they have? And then they sat down, and everyone in the parish who was an adult, they quizzed them on their catechism. Not the doctrine, but can you say the Our Father? Can you say the Hail Mary? And can you say the Creed? By the way, the Creed was not so good. That was only about 20%. But 80 to 85% could recite the Our Father and the Hail Mary. And at the beginning of his reign, they're all doing it the medieval way. They're reciting them in Latin. By the end of his reign, everyone's reciting in Spanish. There was a conscious decision in the early modern period by the church to try and distinguish lay forms of prayer from priestly forms of prayer. In the Middle Ages, I like to tell people, every medieval cleric and monk or nun was a lay person or a laywoman before they became a member of the clergy. Yes, there's more Latin for the clergy and for nuns and for monks, but there was comprehension. There was also participation. Up until the 15th century, at least in Italy, the people in church made the responses, Dominus Vobiscum, Amen, the easy ones. Oh, did I mention that before the 14th century, there was no said service? So they sang it. They sang the answer, Et cum spiritu tuo, to Dominus Vobiscum, the Lord be with you. They sang the Amen at the end of the prayers. And we have witnessed all over, and my favorite is in Verona. There, they had a special thing they did because the problem was the lay people, they didn't have any books. So, Et cum spiritu tuo, Amen, Deo gratias, those are easy. But what do you do for the harder things like the Creed? It's long. So the clergy sing it as they sing the Gloria. Well, the Creed is so important that in several cities, the laity who sang the Kyrie, the prayer that we now know in translation as Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy, well, they did sing that. That's easy. However, at the end of the Creed, what did they do in Verona, Siena, and what was the other city I found this in? Cremona, is after the clergy had sung the Creed, they would all sing a Kyrie to show that they accepted it. So the image of non-participation doesn't fit very well. Although it does start to fit in the early modern period when there's this a strong attempt to separate the way the lay people pray in vernacular from the priests in Latin. And I'll mention this to show you how this what happens. By the 1600s, it is forbidden to do translations of the Mass for lay people, because they're supposed to say their own prayers. The prayers of the Mass are those of the priest. The first time I have found in Italy a complaint about that the lay people are making responses is 1470. It seems by 1400, the lay response and participation is growing down, but it takes that long before someone says, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. I think this is a remainder. So we have to get away from the image of passive laity in church. Not only are the laity not passive in that they can move around, they fit in the space, they go in processions, they do those things, but also they sing, and I hope they pray. It's interesting that one of the qualities of this is that for pre-modern people, prayer is something you do with your mouth, vocal prayer. And in that sense, the laity, whether they're singing their short parts and easy parts of the service, or they're reciting Our Fathers or Hail Marys, which is the very distinctive medieval form of oral prayer for the laity, whether they're doing either of those, they're doing it with their mouth and they're doing it out loud, just as the clergy who are praying, when they recite the office or they say Mass, they're also doing it with their mouth. Prayer is not a mental thing. It is talking to God, praising God. It's not something like the French school in the early modern period where praying is something you do very quietly by yourself and you imagine images of Christ and Our Blessed Lady in the part of their life and so forth. Certainly something like that happened in the Middle Ages, especially when people walked around the church and looked at the pictures. But prayer is essentially verbal. We Dominicans like to call ourselves the Order of the Holy Rosary. And we have always been preachers of it, but it is something that we Dominicans borrowed from the laity. The first example of things that are like the rosary were Our Father beads. They predate us by at least 25 years. By the time Dominic was preaching in the early 1200s, the most common form of prayer for lay people was Pater Noster beads, where they'd count off the beads saying Our Fathers. The addition of the Hail Marys would come later, and we started to promote this, but we borrowed it from the laity. We also borrowed a very famous work. I think the sisters might know, The Nine Ways of Prayer of St. Dominic, very famous, beautiful manuscript. I broke the heart of the head of the Dominican Historical Institute, Simon Tugwell, brilliant historian and scholar, when I found in the municipal library in Vicenza, a manuscript dating to the late 1100s. It has the same pictures in it. It was a series of pictures added to a work on how to pray by a French cleric in Paris. And there are, it's eight ways. The Eight Ways of Prayer was originally a prayer book for Italians and it had been copied by lay confraternities, and there are three copies of it. The Dominican version is much more beautiful, but it's an adaption. Again, we're borrowing from the laity. So the idea of a passive laity and an active clergy starts to look a bit more conflicted. I might add, the Nine Ways of Prayer added only one picture to this book. You can see they're obviously copied off one of these manuscripts or someone after it. The only one that's in the Nine Ways of Prayer of St. Dominic that's not in the three pamphlets written for members of lay confraternities is the one with him flagellating himself. The rest, kneeling, putting his arms to heaven, putting his arms out, all of those motions, originally books for how to pray for the laity, using your body. In fact, the bodily gestures seem to be more as important as the words that are given to use in the text. Sibillina Biscossi, she is my favorite. She knew how to pray. She was a Dominican lay penitent in Prato, and she lived in the late 1200s. She was a freelance hermitess. We have a good number of those in the early days. And so she had herself enclosed in her backyard. there was a little window where she'd come and, you know, she could receive communion. They could take out the trash and bring her food. And she dedicated herself to prayer. She was a great prayer of the Paternoster. She said the Paternoster 3,000 times a day. And as she said the Paternoster 3,000 times a day, for everyone she genuflected. The garden was, as described by her chaplain, was a blasted heath. Her genuflecting had killed all the grass and packed down the dirt. And he said that the women who laid out her body for burial said that her knees were as big as those of camels. This is the body in action with prayer. So what am I saying is that medieval lay prayer was holistic. It involved the whole body, not just in motion, but by gestures. It involved the voice and not just the mind, although the mind is important too. How would people have used their mind quietly? I suggest it's typically with images. How many here have heard the story that the images in medieval churches were the Bibles of the illiterate? Yeah, it's a common thing. Have you ever gone into a medieval cathedral or even a modern Catholic church that has fancy stained glass windows? When you look at the windows, do you know what they're about? If they're not labeled? Medieval paintings weren't labeled, except for maybe occasional saints. You have to know the story in order to read it. The people who look at them may be illiterate, but unless they already know the story, the pictures are worthless. We should never underestimate how much Bible knowledge people had. So I want to do a little bit about what was known by those who participated in what I said. Okay, my favorite of this is a peasant woman in the Pyrenees near a town called Montaillou was inquisited by a man who would later become Pope, Jacques Fournier. And the year is 1303. And he wanted to know from her, had she seen any Cathar preachers, these dualists who believed matter was evil and the material world was made by a bad god like the devil, while only spirit was made by the good God? And she says, oh yeah, I had seen some of those people. And said, did you talk to them? Well, yes, I talked to them. What did they say to you? And she said, well, they said to me that the Hail Mary was made up by the priests and not by God. And he said, then what did you say? And she says, wow, is that right? I always thought it was made up by the Archangel Gabriel. She knows her Bible. So now I have to admit that sometimes what they know, because it's an oral tradition, is they know things that we don't know. Does anyone here know who was getting married at the marriage feast at Canaan? Nobody? Any medieval peasant could have told you who was getting married. Okay, I'll let you in on it. It was the man who would later be John the Evangelist and Saint Mary Magdalene. Now, we all know what John the Baptist did, John the Evangelist did. John the Evangelist went off and followed Jesus. And now you know why Mary Magdalene fell into a life of sin. She was jilted at her own wedding banquet. Now, every medieval peasant would know that. So what I'm saying is you get a larger package. You get also the things that have been left out of the modern Bible. Now, let's move from lay expressions of piety, the way they prayed, the way they moved, what their mental furniture might have been about, and ask, what is their experience of what the clerics are doing in church? First thing to remember is that up until the 1400s, at least in Italy, all the services were sung. There was no said service. So the daily mass, it might be as few as a priest in one cantor is doing the singing, but it was sung from beginning to end, except for silent prayers said by the priest. The next thing that shocks people is when I tell them that every parish priest, everyone who held a pastoral cure, had to sing the entire divine office every day in the parish church. That includes the long services of matins, which are from the early, nighttime into the morning, could last about 2 hours, and the morning praises maybe add another half hour. They were usually traveling or away, so they didn't usually say the day hours like monks who were home all the time, but then they were obligated also to sing Vespers, usually with their clerics. Now, an interesting thing. Here's where the Episcopalians, and I got this from an Episcopal priest, have preserved this where we Catholics haven't. The primary obligation of an Episcopal minister, at least that's what I was told by this one who was in Alaska, I met him there, was to say morning prayer and evensong, not to say the Eucharistic service, but that, and he would come, and in his church, he'd light his candles and wait, and if one person came, if not, he'd go to the pulpit and read it. An obligation that goes all the way back to the Middle Ages. Of course, in the early modern period, Catholic priests started reading all these prayers privately with no singing at all. Now, one of the interesting things that happens in the 13th century is we have a growing number of lay people who want to do more than do. Remember, you're a member of the parish where you hear Vespers and go to Mass? A growing number want to come to Matins, which starts at about, well, maybe 3:30 to 4 in the morning. So the clerics are in there, the parish priest with perhaps his deacon and subdeacon and maybe another cleric. They're in there singing away, and suddenly there are people pounding on the door wanting to get in. My favorite version of this is Ranieri of Pisa. Remember I mentioned him? The guy who got the three guys out of jail? He'd come and bang on the cathedral door in the late 1100s, wanting to get in. Finally, they started letting him in because he'd just keep pounding. And then the bad thing was for the clerics who wanted to get this all over with, they didn't want the laity in there, he started bringing his friends. So soon, they've got to have the church open and all this for, well, the worst part is when Matins is over, they don't want to leave. So there's a famous incident where the parroco of the local church has his clerics bodily dump Ranieri of Pisa, the layman, out the door so they can lock it. Then they all go back to bed. And the pastor, whose name is not recorded, has a dream. And his dream is that there are all these dogs, and they come running after him, and they start chewing his guts out. And then Ranieri of Pisa shows up in the dream and calls the dogs off. From then on, Ranieri of Pisa could stay in the church as long as he wanted, along with his friends. And we can see through the 13th century, it's a strange thing, the sudden growing desire of the laity to be present at what today would only normally be done in monasteries, but at that time was done in every parish church. What else do we see in this period, at least in Italy? Notice I always say that because that's where I work on. There is a growing desire by the laity to receive communion more frequently. Up till the 13th century, the most common practice was quarterly communion at the feasts of Christmas, Pentecost, the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin, and Epiphany. That was the most common. May have been more frequent, and you went to confession 4 times for each of those. Protestants here, how many of you have quarterly communions? 4 times a year? Very common among the Baptists. Used to be very common among Episcopalians. It's another carryover from this medieval practice of communion 4 times a year. Well, famously, in 1215, Catholics were expected by church law to go to the parish priest for confession at Easter time, and then, of course, to go to communion. That doesn't mean that they stopped going at other times of year. The practice of going to communion once a year, which had become very common in the early modern period, doesn't quite fit the Middle Ages where the earlier tradition of more common communions existed. Now, why do I bring this up? What happens in the 13th century? The clergy don't notice it, but there's a growing devotion to the Eucharist among the laity. First, not only do the laity, in Italy at least, start to want to come to the prayer services that start in the early morning and the evening, they also want to go to communion more. Or they want to see the host. What happens? We start to have much more frequent communion. My favorite of these is Per Pettinato, who was a comb maker, a saint, living in Siena, and he wanted to go to communion weekly. And he's known as the local living saint. There's no problem with that. And then people start to imitate. And so what we have, when the older liturgical history said, oh, after 1215, people want only once a year, in the 13th century, there's a growing desire on the part of the laity to go to communion, so greater engagement. Just as there's greater numbers wanting to go to matins and to vespers. Now, I've mentioned about the higher than expected Latin literacy. Where did people get their Latin literacy? Here we have a Dominican that we know a little bit about his growing up. His name was Ambrogio Santadoni. He is the secondary patron of the city of Siena after the Blessed Virgin. And he was from a middle-class family, and he learned to read the Latin Psalter. Anyone want to take a guess who taught him? He's a layman, young man, actually a kid. His grandmother. He learned the Latin Psalter by listening to his grandmother read the Psalter. Okay, where is the keeper of the piece of the medieval page? I brought with you an example, it's actually French, and this is a little nicer than what would be typical, a page from a prayer book, it's from 1400, that was made for a layperson in France near Paris. It's quite pretty. It was given to me as a Christmas gift from friends, and it is a prayer in poetry, it's Latin, to say when the host goes up at Mass. Now, not everyone had the money to do something like this, but one of my projects when I was working on Cities of God was to try and find as many 12th, 13th, and 14th century Italian lay people's prayer pamphlets as I could. I found about 50 of them, and they're quite amazing. They're homemade, and you'll have the Our Father, then maybe some poems like this, but in Italian, then in Hail Mary, then a litany of the saints, and it's not in fancy, beautiful hand like this. It's clearly homemade. So lay people in the 13th century, as part of this revival of piety, are also producing their own prayer books. This is from a Liturgy of the Hours. It was in the back, which are a series of psalms and readings throughout the day in honor of the Blessed Virgin, typically French. The Italian ones of these are collections of prayers, usually taken from the Mass or office, and litanies and so forth. They're not structured like the office. They're a personal prayer book. Inevitably, almost always some Italian, but there'll always be, even if there's a lot of Italian, the Our Father and the Hail Mary in Latin, the sacred language. So the lay people have some books. The devotion to the host. Oh, I just jumped over something. I've been describing rising lay piety in the time of Dominic and Francis. This is the first time, too, when we start to have in saints' lives recording of lay saints criticizing priests. Now, they don't usually do it by saying, oh, that's a bad priest. He doesn't pay attention to what he's doing. He's never around to hear confession. What it is, it happens usually in the lives of visionary women where Jesus comes and gives them a communication. Margaret of Cortona has one of my favorites. There appears to Margaret of Cortona Jesus, and Jesus says this to Margaret of Cortona. My daughter, I complain to you about the great irreverence of priests, who in such great number handle me daily, and yet neither love nor recognize me. If they truly recognize me, they would know that nothing among all the created things anyone might find matches in beauty the priest celebrating Mass. Nevertheless, they dare to touch me, that means the host, with polluted hands, and even more, they make no more of me than they do of the mud in the piazza. This kind of criticism of the lackadaisical, slovenly clergy, one place you find it is Francis of Assisi. Francis of Assisi wrote 9 letters that are preserved. Of the 9 letters, all but 2 have as their topic, this is Francis the Sacristy Rat. He doesn't appear in most stories of Francis. His complaint is that he writes to heads of cities, all the clergy, the lay penitents, all the laity, these short, short letters, and the complaint is dirty altar linen, unpolished chalices, and people not kneeling when the host goes up. It's going to take the clergy always show up late in the Middle Ages. It's going to take some time, but pretty soon these complaints, and remember, Francis is doing them when he's a layman. He's not been ordained a deacon yet. This is the early Francis. Pretty soon, the clergy get around. The lay people, there's this big movement to kneel. You know, lay people have been wanting to kneel since ancient times. What is it? The First Ecumenical Council of Nicaea is ragging on lay people for not standing at Easter time. Well, you got legislation like this, both in the Eastern and Western Church, to stop people from kneeling, at least in Easter time. Clergy in the West rarely kneel. 10 years after Francis is the first painting or sculpture of a pope shown kneeling. He's caught up with the laity. My goodness, I'm running late. So I'm going to shift now. I'm going to talk a little bit about us Dominican clerics. The liturgy of my order is, in origin, basically the liturgy of North France. It looks very similar to the patterns of worship in Italy, but the peculiarities of it are North French, and the reason is that the two centers of activity of my order were the two university cities, and one was Paris, and that was even more important than Bologna in Italy. And there was a lot of movement between the two places, and there was a desire so the friars who went from Bologna to Paris would be able to sing along without music that was different. So from the very beginning, we had this standardization thing, so that when you went from house to house, you could join in immediately at the mass or the office without having tunes that you didn't know or texts you'd never sung. Recent scholarship has shown something very interesting. It shows that the beautiful musical books with the Gregorian music that we have preserved a good number of them, were not done by free hand. They were done with a stencil. So instead of doing it with a pen, you had a stencil, and you would paint through it, and you'd get all the notes, put the bars in, and every stencil had to have been approved that it was correct, so that there would be absolutely, remember this is before printing presses where you could run off hundreds of books or thousands of books. This way, every Dominican monastery of monks and nuns, okay, would have music books that matched exactly. And that was not enough. Before the books could be approved for use, two friars, or two nuns if it's in a monastery of nuns, had to take an already approved book and the new book, and the two of them would sing off the different books, and if there was a clash, they'd then have to correct the new book to match the old one. We have the progenitor volume of these music books. It's in Rome, and it was compiled for Humbert of Romans, who was the one who standardized our liturgy in 1254, although the earlier liturgy was very much like it. So I'd like some characteristics of a liturgy that is monastic, but at which the people were present. First, uniformity. Wherever you are, you can sing along, you can participate, because the text is one you're going to have known. We beat the Council of Trent standardizing the liturgy by, 400 years. Next, our liturgy is marked by sobriety. Things that would be elaborate or exaggerated, we tend away from them. What would be an example? For example, in the Roman liturgy, in the late Middle Ages, there was the introduction of many, many, many genuflections. We never picked them up. Instead, we do a profound bow, except coming in and going out when we genuflect. What else is a characteristic? The increasing use of incense in the late Middle Ages. We never adopted those additions, for example, incensing the altar at the very beginning. So that's another characteristic, sobriety, brevity. Those who have, I know who have done liturgical history or who are interested in modern liturgy since Vatican II, often say, wow, the priest communion prayers of the Dominican liturgy are actually simpler than those of the Novus Ordo. We avoided the additions of things, so it makes our, well, there's virtually no difference between our modern books, except for the number of saints' days and where they are, than they were in the 13th century. We avoid repetition and elaboration. Brevity is the, well, Dominic used to yell in choir, sing loudly, sing strongly, and sing quickly. Benedictines who come to Dominican houses, even today when the liturgy is in English, go, wow, you all sing so fast. And we say, yeah, we have to go write books and we have to go preach. As opposed to monks, you know, what do? They chop some wood or something like that. Next, our liturgy preserves something that was lost in many of the, by the way, I don't think there's anything wrong with the Roman liturgy. It's different. One of the things that happened was, with the rise of the said service, there was a tendency in the solemn service in the standard Roman liturgy to adopt the priest doing almost everything and the other ministers having particular jobs. So in structure, in the Roman liturgy, the deacon does something, and he's done, the subdeacon does something. Then when he's done, the priest does something. And you can have a master of ceremonies who walks around and says, it's now your turn, it's now your turn. In our liturgy, it's organic. Every minister has their own job, and they can do it. So if you were going to be a master of ceremonies in the solemn Dominican liturgy the way it would have done in the Middle Ages, you would have to bilocate and trilocate. Let me give an example. During the Gloria, the subdeacon is out bringing in the Eucharistic, well, the bread and wine. He's bringing it in a procession. At the same time during the Gloria, or during the epistle, it depends on whether there's a Gloria or not, the deacon is unfolding the corporal, the piece of cloth that's put in the middle of the altar, while in both cases the priests are reading prayers that the choir will sing later and he won't be able to do them. And did I tell you that the two acolytes are also doing different things? So one of the characteristics of our liturgy is all the ministers have to mesh with each other and do it together and do their all parts. I call it organic. Everyone does their, all the organs work together. Next, our liturgy is monastic. I can elaborate on that, but I'll give one example, the Easter Vigil. In the modern Roman Rite, the Easter Vigil has the vigil, and then baptisms, and then the Easter Mass. That was also true in the Middle Ages. Our liturgy, because we were monastics and we didn't run parishes, you had the vigil, a litany of the saints, nothing about baptismal font, blessing, because we didn't have them, and we immediately then went into the Mass. This was true up until 1954. So our liturgy is monastic. Now, I'm not going to say much more. Oh, I've got to do one more. Can I, how much time can I have? I'm good, okay. This is a great discovery, and this I'm going to do because the sisters are here. Many Catholics know a famous hymn about Our Lady at the foot of the cross called the Stabat Mater. At this cross or station keeping stood the Holy Mother weeping. That text was believed to have been written by a Franciscan in the late 13th century, Jacopo de Todi. A manuscript from a North Italian Dominican convent was discovered 5 years ago with the text in it, and it comes from a convent of Dominican nuns, and it predates the birth of Jacopo de Todi. This is the earliest example of this hymn. It has some different verses, but it's clearly the same hymn. Now comes the next question. Did the Dominican sisters make it up? And I was the one who discovered this. The music had been, and the text had been published in a journal, and I was looking at this, and I said, wait a minute, I know that music. That music is the sequence of St. Dominic. The earliest example of, so creativity is also going on, even though there is uniformity. And in this case, a famous, well, we quickly adopted it, but here you can see that the nuns themselves are also contributing to the continuous development and embellishment of the liturgy. I had a bunch of things about, other distinctive things about our Mass. I'm going to skip it. I've talked enough about the clergy. What I want to talk about is the clergy and the laity together. The important thing here is something made fun of by Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, during the English Reformation. He's the great Protestant reformer under Henry VIII. He made fun of the constant processions, people going around with candles, singing songs all the time, the laity doing this constantly. This, remember I said the importance of movement, going from place to place. Connect that with music, with people singing, often very simple things like the Litany of the Saints, where the answer is just ora pro nobis, pray for us. You don't have to be a Latin genius to learn to sing that. Processions and moving. The laity like to do it, and Dominicans like to do it. When I entered my order in 1977, as a novice, there was a very old priest, and during meditation, he'd always be walking back and forth up in the choir loft. And I said to him, why do you do that? He says, because I can't pray unless I'm walking. This idea that motion is part of it. Well, processions are about the integration of prayer and moving. Our liturgy, one of its characteristics is, unlike the Roman, where the ministers tend to stand in place for a long time, whenever some major musical event occurs, for example, the intoning of the Gloria, the ministers are in a line, and you have the three major ministers, priest, deacon, and subdeacon, and then behind them you have the two acolytes. They all turn and all swing to the side so that they can all hear each other when they're reciting the music. Then they'll swing back. They do the same thing at the offertory, but to the other side. They form cross shapes. They form triangles. So one of the characteristics of our liturgy is that little processions are going on constantly in it. I think this is another place where the love of the laity for moving around when they pray, doing little pilgrimages, affected also us. The most famous Dominican procession, though, is that at the end of Compline, the singing of the Hail Holy Queen, the Salve Regina. And I mention it because this is one of the cases where the Dominicans imitating what was really something the laity liked, moving around and singing when they pray, we introduced it because of daimonic possession. In 1221, the second head of our order, Jordan of Saxony, became concerned about a diabolical obsession, is what they thought it was, of a brother in Bologna named Bernard. And he writes in his little book on the origin of the order, he writes, it was at this time that we introduced the singing of the Hail Holy Queen, the Salve Regina, at the end of Compline, asking her to protect the friars from diabolical or demonic attack. And, well, as it happened, when they instituted it, Bernard suddenly got better. The attacks went away. Later, we are told that one of the friars, in a dream, saw the Blessed Virgin appear and walk through the dorter where the friars were sleeping, sprinkling them all with holy water to keep the demons off. Well, this was soon connected to leaving your choir stalls and going to the major altar of the Blessed Virgin, which was normally in the people's part of the monastery, outside the Jubbe, outside the Ponte. And so the friars would come out, complete the hymn at the altar, there'd be a prayer afterwards, and then return and go back in. Well, it's in the people's part of the church, so people want to be there. And this, so soon in Bologna and then throughout Europe, one of the most commonly attended things was to attend the Salve procession if you were a layman. You might not get up at 3:30 in the morning to go to Matins and hear the Franciscans and Dominicans sing so much better than the parish priests, as we were told by a Franciscan wag, Salimbene of Parma in 1280. But for this one, you could come and it would only be short. And moderns rejoice in brevity, as Cicero said. What happens then is this becomes the case where it's the clergy are doing something that is a lay practice, and the laity respond by turning up. And it was still, when I lived in Bologna in the 1980s, when I was working on one of my books, we used to have the procession that would come out of the Friar's Chapel, where Dominic is buried, and over to the altar of the Blessed Virgin, and we'd sing the same song, doing the gesture, which we'd start at kneeling, get up, then when you get to the get over to the other altar, when you get to a part where you ask Mary's intercession of Jesus, you all kneel, you get sprinkled with holy water. Well, every night, people would start to arrive, and there would be 20 to 30 lay people there for this devotion each evening. I don't know if it still happens today, but sorry, this is very, very typically medieval for Dominicans. And in this case, I've given examples of how we adopt lay practices, but here's one where something that was instituted within the monastery because of concerns about demons becomes something that becomes the most popular for devotion for lay people, probably more important than Vespers or Matins. And what I wanted to say one more thing about it. Oh, it became so popular that lay people began to demand it. And so in 1240, the Benedictines adopted the practice and opened their doors. And people and normally their services work for themselves alone because they're monks. And finally, Gregory the Ninth in 1251 ordered it to be done, the Salve procession, in all the Roman basilicas, which were not Dominican, Franciscan, they were the secular churches of Rome, and from there it spread throughout Europe. So when you talk about lay piety and clerical piety, the thing to remember is that the modern division of the two that made them very different, that I remember well when I was a child, it's not medieval. And so now I end with the clergy and laity together for the Salve. Oh, one more thing about it. We used to have something called the lector's privilege, which meant that those were teaching theology. The priests would be exempted from having to go to the whole choral office. Because they were supposed to be writing their lectures and things like that, so they'd read the prayers privately. But the one thing they always had to attend was the Salve procession after Compline. So I then end invoking Our Lady's blessing on all of us, and that she always point us to her Son, who lives and reigns world without end.